Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am playing an interview I did with Tobin Ost, who is both the scenic designer and the costume designer for Bonnie and Clyde the musical, which is currently playing on Broadway. Tobin found his way to design in a rather unusual way. It's a really interesting story, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about you and me and all of the rest of us. In the way that I believe, as a psychotherapist and have a lot of experience to support this belief, that we each come out of childhood into the life as we know it, believing that we are less than we are. That is to say that we think of ourselves as having a certain number of qualities, a certain way of behaving, a certain approach to life. And while I think that it's the truth, that what we believe about ourselves is the truth, it's not the whole truth. I believe, and have written extensively on this, and you can read all about it if you're curious in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, which you can find on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W.com. That's if you want to hear more about it. You can hear a little bit more about it in this show and in all the shows I do, because I talk about it in all the shows that I do. I talk about the fact that I believe, and as I said, I have plenty of experience with clients, 30 years worth, to back this up, that we have experiences in our childhood which teach us in no uncertain terms what it is that is acceptable and what is not acceptable, and more than that, what we can expect from the world and what we cannot expect from the world. So if a person had a chaotic childhood, a childhood where parents were sick or alcoholic or divorced, or in some ways not dependable, that is, that life was not predictable, then such a person almost certainly learns not to relax, to be vigilant, to be worried. You hear people say this all the time, you know, I'm just a worrier. I mean, I can't help it. I've always been a worrier. I don't necessarily like it, but I worry. Worry is another word for the technical sort of psychotherapeutic term of projection. That is, to imagine something that's going to happen in the future that is not in fact happening now, and as we all know, may or may not happen, but to feel about it as though it is happening now. This not only is a colossal waste of time, which even the people who identify themselves as worriers will admit, but it's worse than just wasting time. Worry produces a chemical, usually cortisol, which is very bad for the body. And okay, things happen in life which can scare us, upset us, despair us, and generate the production of cortisol. We can't help that. But to create additional cortisol for something that is not only not happening but may never happen, that's a bad thing for our body. And so it is in the interests of people who came into adulthood believing that they had no choice but to worry, to recognize that they do actually have another choice, that other things are possible for them, and that the reason that they feel so compelled to worry is that this is the lesson their childhood taught them in order for them to feel safe. So, I believe that such a person can find within themselves the ability to feel safe, which will minimize the necessity for worry. Now, I'm just talking about one particular quality, the particular quality of worry. But, you know, people say, I never get angry, or I just fly right off the handle. I can't help it. It just happens. Or, I can't confront. I just can't confront. It makes me so uncomfortable to think of confronting anybody. Or, I mean, it's just all thousands and thousands of ways in which people define themselves, limiting themselves, and it isn't necessary. So that's what the Lynn Show is about trying to understand, first of all, that you may be limiting yourself unnecessarily, and then maybe to ask yourself why you are limiting yourself and in what way, and then maybe to begin to think about how to unlimit yourself. And I want to say here that it is not so simple as just figuring it out and saying, oh, I don't have to do that anymore. Oh, okay, good. It's much more complicated, and I do talk about that in some shows, and I do talk about that in the book. And you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, and email me if you have questions about that. The other thing I do with my show, if you've been listening, you know, is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because in order to do that in this culture, it really has to be who you really are. You can't pretend to be that in this culture. It's just too hard. And you hear it over and over again in all of the people that I interview. Today, I am interviewing or playing an interview I did with Tobin Ost, who is an unusual combination. Generally speaking, you do not find scenes designers and also doing costume design. Usually that's a separate thing. But Tobin is an anomaly. He's a special case, and he does both, and he has done both for Bonnie and Clyde the musical, and this is an opportunity for me to give a plug for Bonnie and Clyde the musical. If you saw my e-blast or you heard last week's show, you know that I believe that the critics who were not kind to the show were absolutely wrong. And it is my hope that you will not be put off by that, and that you will decide to trust yourself and go to see this show, which is wonderful in every single way. And one of the ways in which it is terrifically wonderful is Tobin's sets. So I could say a lot about Tobin and how he discovered his particular skill, but I think I'll just let him do it. So here now, Tobin Ost. So here I am with Tobin Ost in a tiny hotel room in Manhattan, and he just ran up from rehearsal. And Tobin is the
set and costume designer
for Bonnie and Clyde the Musical.
Yep.
I interview people who make their living or their life within art, which you clearly do.
I guess they do.
Yes, you do. You do. And I always ask the same question. How did it happen? What was the first moment when it occurred to you that design or costume or color or shape or was interesting to you, turned you on, got your attention? Do you know what I'm asking?
Absolutely. It's that aspect, the quote-unquote artistic aspect.
Yes.
I was fortunate enough to have several aunts who were art teachers, and they had crayons, pencils, Cheerios, feathers in our hands from the get-go. And my grandmother on the other side of my family was an oil painter, so that influence was there from the beginning. As far as applying it in any sort of direct way to deciding to be,
be
a set designer,
right,
or be a theater, that was much more insidious, the way it snuck up on me. I thought I was going to be an architect, actually. I'd always had this profound interest in spaces and architecture. And one summer, I approached the local architect in my hometown to see, hey, can you use somebody to stir your coffee and look over your shoulder?
And how old were you here?
At this point, I think I was a sophomore in high school.
Okay. So I just want to stop and back up just a little bit. You say we had feathers and Cheerios and everything. Do you mean your classmates? Do you mean your sisters and brothers? Do you mean
me and my brother?
And your brother.
Yeah, and right. And any young people in our family, all my cousins and
whatnot. We're always sort of messing around with artistic materials.
Exactly.
Right?
You'd be in one of my aunt's houses without being in contact with a piece of clay or something like that. And I remember gluing actually said Cheerios and feathers to her wallpaper. She wasn't overly thrilled with, but I thought it was
yes,
great.
and hard to criticize you when she's given you the glue
exactly.
And the Cheerios. Right. So now, did they say to you, oh, how artistic, or how interesting, or, oh, you seem to like this, or you're good at it, or any of that? Or they just, it was more matter of fact, everybody does this, no big deal?
It was, I certainly got the support from home, from everybody in our family. In school, it was something that I got as well, but it was almost a chiding from classmates who were like, oh, the artist. That's why, to this day, I don't necessarily like that word, because at that time, when peer pressure is so great, you want to kind of blend in with everybody else.
Yes.
And so for me, it was always a word that was loaded. Similarly, at home, when I go back to Michigan, small town in Michigan, I'm Toby. I'm not Tobin. My real name is Tobin, but everybody, including my parents who named me Tobin, still call me Toby. I changed because there are so many domestic pets named Toby, I can't tell you. Cocker Spaniels, Chihuahuas, so many named Toby that when I moved out away from home and got kind of a clean start, as it were, I started going by Tobin.
Wow.
So,
but again, what's in a name?
Exactly.
you know.
Yeah.
And an artist by any other name would still be an artist, right? You know, I mean, so you did get, that's the other thing. I mean, you're male,
mm-hmm.
And traditionally little boys are not. I mean, were lots of your little boy friends interested in Cheerios and feathers?
Not so. By the way, I'm still interested in Cheerios and feathers. They yeah. Still have a place on stage,
oh.
I'm convinced.
Oh,
but no, to your point, not usually. Not to necessarily place a gender on it, but yeah, most of my buddies.
There wasn't what I'm asking was, did you, because you talked about being chided a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't dissuade you. It just embarrassed you a little bit.
Yeah,
right?
And not even that heavily. It's just, I don't know if this sounds a little too harsh, but moving on in life, I almost feel like occasionally, you've heard the phrase, the people who have the least to say keep on saying it.
Yes.
And to some degree, when somebody is a self-proclaimed quote-unquote artist and they beat their chest with this phrase, it's like, you are what you are, you know.
You don't have to defend it.
Exactly.
Right, present it with neon.
Yeah. And to me, it has certain connotations the same way somebody saying, oh, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer.
Yes.
It evokes certain things. And for some people, those are very positive, and for others, maybe not so, or he's the flake, he's the this, he's the that. And
that actually is an interesting philosophical position, I think. The idea that, now I'm extrapolating here, so you'll tell me if I got it wrong, that one is what one is, and that should be clear from what one does, that one doesn't have to proclaim it. Is that accurate?
I think so. It's kind of, I keep, you know, throwing out these little sayings, but walk softly, carry a big stick.
Yes.
I don't like to wear art, as it were, on
your
my sleeve.
Right, yeah.
And it is interesting why I'm uncomfortable with that. I have certainly no problems with anybody who does. For me, though, I think, truthfully, I prefer the word design,
yes,
and that I'm a designer, in the sense that, and getting back to theater a little bit, it's such a collaborative art. You're taking into account so many things. There's art on the stage, I suppose, if we really want to get down to what that word means, but it's channeled and diffused through so many other departments and so many other people you're working with that it's never in its pure form. I think occasionally of, I need to just pick up a paintbrush and paint something for myself, or I need to just make something for the sheer joy of doing it, not because it's related to a show or something like that. But when I'm left with that decision, it scares me almost to death, because I start overthinking what it is. When you are the master of what you're putting out there, and then there's nobody saying do this or do that, what are you going to do? And so I start thinking, is it too trite? Is it too this? Is it too that? And end up not doing it. Now, truthfully, I haven't been blessed with the problem of, oh, now I have time, I'm going to paint this painting. Usually, like, the work just keeps on coming, and I'm very blessed and fortunate that that's the case. But I guess to boil it down further, when you work in theater, it's all about the story. It's all about a play, a scenario, a piece of music, something that you are trying to help illuminate. So you're hanging your hat on an infrastructure that already exists. And if you're not honoring that, then it does bring into question, are you a good designer? Because your point is not to confuse, you're working with others to tell the story in with a strong perspective. And in that case, I'm always bouncing my ideas off of a conceit that already exists. That I can work with, that I can make better. But when I'm left with presenting my own conceit as a quote-unquote artist and making my own piece of work, that just kind of stupefies me. I don't quite know where to go with that.
It sounded like what you were saying was, when somebody asks you for something, gives you something to work towards, then that turns on something for you.
Luckily, one of my greatest collaborators and friends, Jeff Calhoun, who directed Bonnie and Clyde and virtually everything that I've been blessed to work on in the last 8 years, his approach is very much, let's start working on it now. We could be a year away, but let's start sowing the seeds. Let's just start percolating. It doesn't mean that what we start percolating on is anything remotely close to what we're going to end up with in the end, but it gives us the time to actually start working through a scenario and say, what if we designed it this way? And then, no, we'll go back on it, and we can go back on it. That's very helpful to me, having the structure of him saying, let's get started this early.
Right.
You're absolutely right. I think the framework of somebody presenting you with a task, with a chore, with a challenge, as it were, even if that's just a script sitting there on the table glaring at you,
yeah,
that's enough for me to go
on. It turns you on,
It
right?
absolutely does.
Yeah.
And, And unfortunately, and also what's so great about working with Jeff is that you can't work in a vacuum. I don't know that I can design something completely unrelated to how he's blocking it or any sort of choreography that's going to take place. That's a disservice to a whole segment of the production process that is profoundly going to influence.
Also, talk to me about this. Of course, clearly, I mean, if he's going to dance over here, you can't have a.
That's right.
Something there that he's going to step on, right? Right.
Yes.
So, let me take you back because I really want to hear about this. But take me back to the. You thought you were going to be an architect.
Okay.
And you're a sophomore.
Yeah, and so I'm at the architect's office, mm-hmm. and he basically said we couldn't possibly hire a sophomore from high school or take one on as an intern or even as a shadow. We only take people from college. And so I walked out slightly bummed about this, but across the street it was a community theater, a gem of an old theater, where only a year prior I had essentially gotten bitten by the theater bug, just doing some acting and having a good time with it. It's often anybody's way into the theater. Like, that's the first. It doesn't matter who you speak to. It could be a stage carpenter. It could be somebody in administration. But it's that first initial traipsing about on stage that got me in the door.
So let me ask you, did you audition for something?
I did, yeah.
And do you know why you auditioned for it? And when did you do that?
Well, initially, even prior to being on stage, I did a little backstage work. It looked interesting to me, and it did have some vague resemblance
to architecture. And what were you, 12?
I'd say probably 14 at that point, yeah.
And how did you find the theater?
It's right in a very small town. It's hard to miss. It is one of kind of the crown jewels, as it were, in our community. Theater from, it's basically from the 1850s, beautiful old space, wonderful sized stage that has a very compelling list of things that they wanted to do, musicals, plays, even opera.
So your family was interested in theater?
Not necessarily my family. Actually, I was an anomaly. Nobody in my family actually had any connection to theater whatsoever.
Okay, so I really want to see if we can find where the very first thing is. I mean, you walk by the theater and you think, gee, this is beautiful, I'd like to have something to do with it.
I would take it back even further to just, it sounds too mystical or profound to say a gut instinct, but that's what it was.
No, it's not at all. I think I hear this a lot. So do you remember when you first got that gut instinct?
I was sitting in the audience watching a production of Pirates of Penzance. My mother had taken me there. And there was a moment in the staging where, and remember, this is a community theater, but the administration and my mentor, who's the mentor to many, theater, had designed the set where a ship actually pivoted on stage and the whole prow with the about 15 feet worth of boat came out over the audience, right over my head.
God.
And my jaw was in my lap. I'd never seen anything like that. And just the spectacle that was happening on stage really, really wowed me. And
how old were you then?
I would probably say I was 9 or 10.
Yeah.
Similarly, though, I would say, and this is a complete tangent, but I remember watching a PBS show about Japanese theater, traditional Japanese theater, specifically No, which is a dance drama done mm-hmm. with white masks, and thinking how incredibly beautiful it was. And for an 8-year-old, I can't tell you why I thought that was beautiful. There's certainly no history with that. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know how to process it, but ironically, it comes back in college when I went to Japan for a year and a half to study, and actually study specifically that type of theater.
Yeah, you know, this is, of course, what I was asking you, you know, because for most people who wind up especially in theater, or even, fine artists, musicians, you know, there are moments like this very early on that are not, I don't know, by which they get captured. They don't necessarily say, I want to be a dancer or an actor or in theater or anything, but the memory of that, mm-hmm. I mean, my guess is you can still remember, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have these early experiences, and then you go back to audition to be in a show or to work in a show, or right?
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep.
And, yeah, go ahead.
And it, I mean, it was wonderful just being on stage. It's interesting also, I should say, as a young person, I've compared notes with a lot of people, actors and whatnot. We have a couple of very young people in Bonnie and Clyde. And it demands a different sort of respect when older people are working with younger people backstage. Suddenly, people who might be a teacher of mine, say, in high school, Mr. So-and-so, is no longer Mr. So-and-so when you're on stage with them. The community changes based on who you're in a production with, and there's a camaraderie that exists where age seems to matter less. And I found that kind of refreshing and interesting as well.
I'll bet.
So
yeah, you're a colleague, you're a peer.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And frequently, I mean, think of a show like Annie. Adults are, you know, pretty secondary to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the ones who are the focus, and so. It's a great equalizer, theater, sometimes, in terms of what roles we play and the interactions on stage and off stage.
It's funny because I interviewed the other day a guy who's in My Fair Lady in Sarasota.
Okay.
That's going to open soon. And this is exactly his experience. As a child, he was in a community theater production with adults, and it changed his life.
Right.
You know?
I'm sorry, I don't know if this is where you'd head, but the natural progression here would be that the other thing regarding this theater was, it was incredibly important, I think, because this mentor that I had, his name's Robert Soler, he gave a lot of us opportunities that other community theaters probably either didn't have the luxury of, or the building, or any of these things. I speak about this place as architecture. Let's talk about who's in it. And here we have this this man who saw kind of the potential, I guess, this kernel in so many people. I'm certainly not by any means the only one. There are probably no less than 20 to 30 people through the decades of working with him have gone on to New York to either be performers, to be lighting designers, to be stage managers, and to be set designers. And that largely comes from the curiosity that he allowed us to explore. It was a big lab, this theater, for us. And so after I had been essentially turned away from this architect's office, I crossed the street to the theater and I said, hey, do you need somebody to swing a hammer for the summer? I'd been backstage. I knew that I could at least pound a nail. And they took me on. And then he had seen something, some interest I had had, and had me, the next production was Carousel. He had me kind of draw out some carousel horses, just simple plywood carousel horses. And then that step went to, could you help me paint a drop for the set? And then next step was, here's the set that's been designed. Can you frost the cake and paint the entire thing? And with time, he gave me more and more control, and suddenly I was designing La Traviata, the opera, and musicals. And,
wow!
And it was, I say it's insidious, because it really just kind of crept up, and he just kept giving more and more latitude to play and explore. And sometimes he would let me play with ideas that he didn't even know would work, but he didn't tell me that. He just said, let's go for it and see what would happen.
Not unlike Jeff.
That's absolutely correct,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when I graduate from high school, remarkably, I have a portfolio of all of this work, and I started applying to schools thinking, this is absolutely what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a set designer. And just assumed that every other high school had any number of other people who had the same experience, that community
and
theaters
discovered
across the nation are much the same.
Right,
know.
And discovered that isn't true.
And that's when I discovered I was very lucky. And
very special and very unique.
Well, just to be in this place at this time, because, you know, had this combination of events not happened, I would probably be an architect now. I may be very happy being an architect, but, there are people in your life who are immensely important.
Oh, yes.
And Mr. Soler, as everybody calls him, is that person.
Well, it seems to me that while being an architect might have satisfied you in some way, it might have given you the pleasure of design, but this is giving you the pleasure of design and the pleasure of being in the theater, mm-hmm. which is separate and wonderful all by itself.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And architecture, I mean, you know, I mean, it's interesting because it would have given you the same kind of thing. You know, they would have said, well, we want this house and we needed to have such and such and such, or we want this building and it needs to be such and such and such, because architects don't go out in the world and build whatever they want.
Right.
Right? So in a way, it's got that similar piece.
That's absolutely, it is similar in that the script, as it were, is the life of your client.
Correct.
Or the life of the office building you're designing.
Right, of the work.
Right.
Right, but that's it. It's not this collaborative, wonderful thing with dancers and singers and actors and,
right.
you know, and that's special and wonderful all by itself. So it seems to me that the universe chose well for you.
I'd say. Mm-hmm. Pretty happy. It's also, I think, it's both fulfilling and frustrating at the same time, is that, you know, architecture changes slowly with time. There's trends. What's being built currently, say, in Times Square in another 20 years is going to look obsolete.
Yeah.
No matter how clean we think we're being with our ideas, at the end of the day, it's going to be a monument to a period of time.
Right.
I think that's inescapable. Whereas with theater, I think what's interesting is that you can hide behind history. How many shows really take place in the contemporary? I mean, you have musicals from the 40s that want to be set in the 40s. Bonnie and Clyde is set in the late 20s into the 30s. You're never given just one time period to work within. You have to become an expert across the board, not only in terms of periods, but also maybe locations within our country, locations within the world. I had a show where we were, within 6 months, basically designing the Rwandan genocides of the 1980s. And most shows are a little more trivial than that, but to wear that mantle of suddenly, I need to represent what happened here to the best of my abilities and as authentically as I can, not only because that's what's going to look the best, but also because it's telling the story of a whole group of people, and you want to tell it to the best of your ability, visually.
So, so does this challenge you? Does this turn you on? Does this, I mean, this idea of having to continually be learning?
Well, I call myself a research whore.
Yeah, right. I knew it. I knew it.
And it's also a great way to procrastinate if I'm not having ideas and the proverbial creative juices aren't flowing. Crack open a book, go online, research a little bit more about the period in which you're dealing with or the event you're dealing with. In the case of Bonnie and Clyde, it is a real event. These people existed. I would say those who watch the movie Bonnie and Clyde will be pretty taken back by where we've headed, because that movie had a very strong point of view. Ours is based on 13 points of views or more. I'm not exactly sure. Please cross that with Ivan. But, you know, the police had a certain point of view. Bonnie's mother had a point of view. Blanche, who is one of their members, had a point of view. And this is the best compilation of all those different views. And, of course, you're also dealing with this with the Great Depression in the background. And what does that mean? Especially now when, you know, there's still people alive who went through this. And, again, trying to honor what those things are. At the end of the day, you're probably not going to use all that research. And you want to do what looks good on stage and what honors the script, and clothing-wise, what looks the best on your characters. But all the same, as long as you know what that is the jumping-off point, the springboard. You often hear of fine artists who paint in the abstract. You never see the beautiful figures that they are able to do. You know, they were trained in that. They were trained in classical painting, but they decided to go off in this direction.
Right.
And so as long as you have an arsenal full of you, what you know it should be, that I think gives you the braves to move forward and make it what you want it to be.
Well, but also, I mean, I think what I'm hearing, of course, is this dedication to quality, to making it as perfect as you can, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
I can't imagine not. It's,
no, of course not.
And it's funny because so everybody fixates on any number of things in their life. Everybody, this is a pattern for everyone. However, to sit in the audience and see that one ashtray that's not right up there, sometimes it boils down to that. You know, it's a great place to get lost in detail.
Well, yes, but the point you're making also is that that after you've got all the details, you look at it and you see what you actually need in there and what you don't. Hmm?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Right.
It's also interesting because so many productions these days, whether they're plays or musicals, are written very cinematically. They move like film. If you think back to kind of the quote-unquote old chestnuts, the old shows from, say, the 50s, 40s.
Oklahoma.
Exactly. They were designed with an economy that fit the stage where you would have a big scene and a curtain would come down and actors would play a little scene in front of it while the scenery behind was being changed, and then voila, look, there goes the curtain, now we're in another big scene.
Right.
Now audiences don't want to see that, largely. They're used to seeing scenery move, to the scenery quite literally being choreographed.
Right.
There's incidental music being designed and built into the show so that the whole thing is this motion.
Right.
As far as cinema and theater goes, though, and the fact that you could have a scene that's all of 5 seconds in one location and then bounce to another, I would say that doesn't, even if you had all the money in the world, it doesn't mean each one of those scenes you're going to want to be a fully fleshed out item. You don't want to bring the whole show to a screeching halt just so that you can rumble your big set on stage
mm-hmm.
for 5 seconds. So what that means in terms of what we do is designing largely spaces that are neutral, and then you're bringing in and peppering it with moments and with elements that help tell you exactly where you are. That could be as simple as a light that flies in from above or a desk that rolls on, and that's why suddenly that ashtray is so important, because when you're on a stage that is relatively general and you're telling a whole office with one
with
little
that,
moment,
then you need to have that be what it needs to be.
Exactly.
Okay, so so what you're beginning to do for us is give us a little crash course in set design, right? You know,
maybe personal musings on that. Other people could probably say, no, it's all about this. But
well, okay, this is the crash course in set design by Domino.
Exactly. Right. For me, though, it is the choreography of the scenery is exciting to me. The motion
clearly.
Of it. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's, I've, again, been fortunate enough to work with a lot of scripts where they do move around a lot, and you do fly through different locations. And that's a whole other element to contend with, because just because you're getting from point A to point B, you want to do that gracefully.
Well, and with a very creative director. I mean, so, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Okay, so how did you get into costume?
That came much later, more of a choice once I got into grad school. It was a program where they had you study sets, lighting, and costume, all three. And you'd be designated or earmarked as one. You'd come under the aegis of one. But it didn't necessarily mean that you had to leave that way. And so I boldly stated that I also wanted to be a costume designer, even though I'd had very little, I'd had no costume design experience. And so.
And do you know where that came from?
No. Honestly, it just looked interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could say more, but undergrad had shown me enough, kind of watching from the periphery and seeing what was going on stage, that, you know, costumes in and of themselves can be a certain kind of architecture on stage.
Yes, of course.
And I just wanted to know more about it. And so lighting to me, lighting, I should say, I have nothing but the utmost of respect for. It can make or break the look of a show, of scenery, of costumes. But that being said, for me, it was a language that just
didn't speak to you.
Not as much. I mean, I can look at a stage and say it would be great if there was a shaft of light here, there, or the other thing. But the aspects of the instruments that you use and the technology you use, and it's a whole language. language in and of itself,
right,
that either I found daunting or just not interesting enough to personally to pursue.
It's interesting. I don't know that much about lighting, but it seems to me that the things that you chose to work with, I can't think of what the word to describe what I'm thinking of is, but they have more pieces somehow, mm-hmm, you know?
Right.
They require more putting together.
Yeah.
You know?
Lighting's very ephemeral. It's,
yes.
It's
often, yeah, they're more concrete and more, in a way, they're more tactile, aren't they?
They absolutely
set
are.
Set and costume.
Yes, yes. I mean, lighting is a hunch when you think about it. I mean, poor lighting designers, if you go to a what we call a meet and greet, which is the first, the coming together of the entire cast, crew, for the first reading of the script, usually the set designer will show a model and talk about, be able to visually demonstrate this is what it's going to be. And
right,
the costume designer can stand there and say, here's a costume sketch for this, and you're going to be wearing this, and here's my research that goes with this. The poor lighting designer...
I'm going to shine a light over here,
exactly,
and then I'm going to take,
yeah,
a light out over there.
I mean, they rarely say anything. Well, it's kind of going to be lit this way or that, but until they're actually in the theater,
yeah.
I mean, they do all their homework. They do great plots of lighting in order, what instruments and the colors and all of this, but they're in the hot seat once you're actually in the theater. Then
right,
you see that come to life.
Right.
It's almost a fast tracking, whereas the set and costume designer have had months to work and have visual results. The poor lighting designer won't get one until probably the last 10% of the whole process.
Okay, so how did you meet Jeff?
We had been... A wonderful man named Ray Clausen, a designer, I had met here in New York, and I was in grad school at the time, and we were picketing, believe it or not, a production here in town. It was Corpus Christi. It was a show that was getting a lot of, for lack of a better term, anti-gay backlash, and the theater was basically going to take it out of the season. And so there was a counter demonstration out front of the theater, mm-hmm, in which students from Yale, NYU, other organizations coming together to say, you know, this is...
Are you kidding?
Yeah, and, you know, this is freedom of speech. This is the kind of thing that, you know,
right,
we need to have these things in the theater.
Right.
And I met Ray
in the line.
In this picket, yeah. And he very sweetly offered to essentially take me under his wing. He's like, I know you're up at school a lot and you're busy, but, you know, occasionally I have events and parties here in the city, and I'd love it if you could come down. And he started to get me familiar with kind of the New York scene, which up to that point I had a little
again
experience with, but not an enormous
No,
amount.
Yet again,
yeah,
someone comes and sees you and...
So.
And encourages you and helps you and gives you stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he had given me a call. I still remember it. me and my family were camping in the Smoky Mountains. And he said, I had just graduated at this point, I should say. And he said, I know you're really interested in costume design and you don't have a lot of experience. We're doing a backers audition for this show called Brooklyn. There's very little money, but the show is all done with found objects and garbage and trash and things like that. Would you be interested in doing the clothing for this? And I said, well, if it's garbage and trash, I certainly can do that. You know, don't give me any $250, you know, lace, but I can do hefty cinch sacks. And so he brought me on board, and it was a modest, very modest production just to get money that we produced the living hell out of. Because so much of the storytelling was actually the actors on stage basically telling the lives of homeless people who tell this very fantastic story using things that you could find on the New York street. And anyway, Ray had given me a call in a tent by a kerosene lamp sketching some preliminary ideas about a script that I had not even read to present to Jeff when I got back from this trip. Jeff and I met, he saw the sketches, and something with that he really liked, and so he signed me on, and it was kind of low pressure at that point too, because it was this backers audition. If he ultimately didn't like me at that point, you know, I could easily go away. But that in turn moved, they got enough money to move it to a theater in Denver, and then from Denver it ended up on Broadway. And so similarly, it kind of was insidious, and it came from
and the yet again.
Yep. It you know, it wasn't.
You've been guided, right? No, well, don't go there. Go here.
Well, if I was faced with, okay, you're doing a show in, say, antebellum America with huge hoop skirts and laces and that, I probably would have been a deer in headlights, because my experience level at that point was not something that could...
But that wasn't like that. What you were offered, any more than the first job you had in the community theater was design a set.
Exactly.
You know, it
baby
was...
steps.
Right.
Yeah.
And that sort of...
Right.
It's been lovely. It's been very lovely.
Yes, it's been lucky, too. I will definitely say it's...
Well, you know, certainly it looks like luck, but I've heard this story over and over again. I mean, you know, Jeff's story with Tommy.
Hmm.
You know?
Oh, yeah, you spoke with Jeff then.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's an amazing interview.
Yeah.
And it's another story of that. You know, I mean, I suppose you know the story of how he met Tommy.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And he says he understood him. He understood him? He understudied him? He was his understudy.
Yes. He understood him. I like that.
Right. He did that too. He was 16. And he was the understudy because he was the only person who was tall enough to fit into Tommy's costume. He couldn't possibly do the part, but he was the only one who could fit into Tommy's costume, so he became his understudy.
Wow.
Right?
Right.
And he was there with him, there with him, there with him, and...
It happened.
And it happened, right?
Yeah.
And that's just, I mean, I have dozens of stories like that. Enough to make me think that for some people it simply meant.
Right.
You know? And
I mean, once again, who was I at this point? I was fresh out of school, and I could put projects on paper, I could sketch them, but to have somebody really of Jeff's pedigree and background taking a chance on me and saying...
And this is what Jeff would have said about Tommy.
So...
You know? He was nothing. He was 16! You know?
Right.
And that's that thing. It's magic. But, as Tommy was right about Jeff, Jeff was right about you. You know? And that is, I think, how it is. That people do see it. They see the quality. They see the commitment. They see the drive. They see the creativity. They see the spark, whatever it is. They don't do it random. You know, they don't...
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. And in part, I mean, I finally feel I'm at a point far enough away from grad school, enough entrenched in what I'm currently doing to try to give back. And similarly, it's profoundly important to me that if somebody approaches me with an interest in working or an interest in learning whatever few nuggets of thought I can give to them, it's at the top of my list of something that's important. Because, again, if I was fortunate enough to be in a position where people took a chance on me, it's something to give back to the universe.
Let me say this to you. did you say, was it Alf? Or Ralph, the guy who you met on the picket line?
Oh, Ray.
Ray,
yes.
Ray. Ray wasn't looking. He found you. And Jeff wasn't looking. You were there. And Tommy certainly wasn't looking. You don't have to look. They'll find you. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
You can just trust that whoever you're supposed to sponsor
right.
will show up in front of you.
Right. Right.
It's lovely to talk to you because the commitment to quality is so clear. And you do see it in the theater, but you don't see enough of it in the world.
Mm.
That's how I feel about it anyway. I mean, maybe that's not true, but I think it is.
Right.
You know? So, how old are you?
38.
38? Wow, you don't look 38.
Do you say only, or?
No, you don't look 38.
Oh.
You look 60. Younger than that. Yes. Yeah, well, not quite 16. But yeah, right. Okay, so having given all of these years, and really, if you start counting at the first experiences in community theater, You have given a lot of time and energy and life and creativity to theater.
Mm-hmm.
Do you just want to think about what that's like, what that feels like, what that means to you, or anything that you want to say about it?
Oh, boy. It's a dangerous word, but believe it or not, sometimes ambivalence is an awful good word.
Yeah.
Because it's something that you love. It is so under your skin. There's any number of professions in the world that are made, well, in this economic climate, I don't know if I can even say this, but that, dare I say, are more stable. The one thing about being a freelance designer is that it's freelance. And the one thing that bothers me probably the most is knowing, you know, where your next paycheck is coming from, you know? God knows when you tally up the hours, you're usually working far more than what that paycheck is, but you're doing it for the love of it. And that's fine with me. It's just knowing that you still have that paycheck coming and that you can bank on knowing what your future is, and sometimes you don't. There's a little bit of miss there. That's the one element to what I do that sometimes I feel the freelance component. And I suspect this would be the case regardless of what freelance I was doing.
Yes. Architect wouldn't be much safer.
Much safer, exactly. This is true. So, but that being said, once again, I've been nothing but fortunate to pull through this many years and solely do this.
Yes.
To even have a partner completely outside of a theater who, you know, within the last couple of years faced being unemployed and being able to be the provider, which sometimes you wonder if that can even happen in theater.
Surprise!
But one thing that I guess you realize is that one of my friends summed it up this way, and this was in grad school. We had to make a whole series of candles for a production. And we're sitting there on the floor dripping hot melted glue down chunks of PVC. And I said, I was grousing, and I said, when's it going to get better than this? Like, when are we ever going to, like, when does it move on from hot melted glue on candles, on PVC? And he said, it never moves on from this. This is what it is. And he has a point. It's like, you see some of the best things going on Broadway, and you still see the hot melted glue up there. That's my way of saying that there's a comfort, in a sense, that what was going on in that community theater where I got started is not so necessarily different from what's happening on the proverbial Great White Way, that the difference between a small town in Michigan and a big stage in New York, there's seemingly fewer steps between than I think a lot of people understand. It's easy to take Broadway and mystify it, I think, and to give it a sparkle and a glitter and a glamour, but a lot of people are actually amazed when you take them for a tour of a backstage, and they're like, oh my God, the backstage of my hometown theater is bigger than the space that this enormous show is taking place on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that puts it in a very good perspective, that the work you are doing, wherever you are, should be done
well. It's the work,
and
right.
That's what's important, and that's what's fulfilling, is making it the best you can, regardless of what venue it's in. And as you say, completing it, making it a project that you're proud of.
You're proud of, yeah, I know. And I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Tobin.
Absolutely.
So once again, you hear loud and clear from the mouth of someone who is making his life and living from a creative work. I'm not going to use the word art because it's not a description that Tobin feels comfortable with, although I think pretty much anybody else who's seen his work would call him an artist. We don't need to make him uncomfortable. But you hear it, you know, not for the money. It's not stable. He does it because it's part of him. He does it for the love of it. He does it because he needs to do it. He does it because it is him. And as always, I am hopeful that when you listen to this kind of commitment, this kind of attachment to the life a person is living, that you know that that's possible. And if there's any way in which you are shortchanging yourself, any way in which you believe there's something you could be, might have been, would have liked to be, and I'm not talking here about a career, I'm talking about the way you are in the world, please honor that. At least think about it. As we are entering, well, as we are exiting this year and facing a new year, maybe this is a good time just to ask the question, who could I have been? And are there qualities that I have denied, that I suspect that I actually have, but have been unable to surface and access? Just ask. And if you want to talk about that more, you should go up on my website and email me and ask me some questions. Oh, I need to do as I always do, is to thank Josh Hackney, my IT guru, who saves my life over and over and over again. Everyone should have a Josh, and in fact, you can have him to save your IT recording computer life. You can have him by going up on my website and emailing me and say, get me Josh, and I will. And if you're a social media person and you use Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or any of the others and you like us, please go up there and say you like us. Okay, so I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. Something that you didn't know, some information that you got, something about set design or Broadway theater or anything at all. Something that'll bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with some tang.